Please welcome our speaker, Mike S. from Riverside, as our speaker tonight.
Hi, my name is Mike S. and I'm an alcoholic. Good to be here tonight. I was just sitting there trying to figure out how many days I've been sober so I can fit in with the group. Lee, thank you for inviting me to come up here. It's always fun on a Saturday to get up and drive about 4.5 hours to a meeting, especially through Santa Barbara. I am glad to be here, and before I forget, Sal, you're doing a good job. It's the first time he said he's led a meeting. Or I don't know if it's actually accurate or not, but he said he did. Do you hear feedback?
He's working on it.
I've been sober since May the 30th, 1980. I've been sober a little over 43 years. And I'm one of those kind of people who came into Alcoholics Anonymous with no conscious desire to stop drinking. And I don't mean even a slight one. I wasn't looking for sobriety. I certainly wasn't looking for groups that gave out chips. I wasn't looking for friends. I wasn't looking for just looking for some good sound equipment. That's all I was looking for. God, I hear myself twice. Anyway, I'll get to that in a minute. Congratulations to all of you who celebrated your milestones, whatever they were. I was so, by the time I came into AA, and I'll actually work my way back to that point in a minute, but I was thinking of it as you were getting your chips and they were calling out the lengths of sobriety and that kind of stuff. Those kind of little things in Alcoholics Anonymous made me so uncomfortable that I almost didn't stay just because of that stuff. You know, I'd gotten here, it's a terrible way to live. I have a lot of emotions I'm going to talk about tonight that make sure that I'm never quite comfortable. You know what I'm saying? And one of them is the fact that I walk into a place and feel much cooler and more special than other people, but intimidated at the same time. It's a terrible mix. I'd like to be one or the other. Either just so scared I just shut up, or not so cocky that I wouldn't even be worried about the fact I wasn't getting attention. But that wasn't the way it ever was for me. But by the time I was around here for a little while, and they started doing things, those first meetings I came into down in my hometown, they had us get up and identify like they asked tonight for people that were new, and they asked us to stand up and say our names. And you know, by then, that kind of thing was almost too much for me to do. And it wasn't because I didn't know my name. I mean, I still remembered it. It was the fact that I might not look good saying it. You know, I was more concerned about my appearance. AA is not a place for cool people like me. You know what I'm saying? I walked in and knew right away that those kind of little things or singing happy birthday off key were not my home. I didn't want to be there anymore or hang out with those kind of people. But I'll get to why I end up staying here in a minute. Let me start at the beginning. I was born in upstate New York, from back east, where a lot of us live together by our nationalities, our ethnic backgrounds. I'm of Italian descent, so I lived in a neighborhood where there were Italians. And my father owned a bar, and it was up on a corner right next to my grandmother's restaurant, and it was a really special place for me as a child. My father was an alcoholic, a practicing alcoholic, but in my opinion, just a great guy. I mean, he wasn't mean. I will talk about the kind of pain he caused our family as time goes on, but he wasn't purposely mean. And I've got ideas about drinking when I was little that were going to affect me way before I ever took a drink of anything. And one of them was this. I saw my dad, I would go into that little bar, or later on he ran nightclubs. And my brother and I would go in there, we're about 18 months apart, and we'd sit around, and everything in there was special. You know what I'm saying? It was just a fun, there was something about the atmosphere of it early in the morning when they were setting up. I had an uncle named Dominic who was pouring the drinks behind the bar. It was air conditioned, they had pinball machines. It was just, and my dad and his friends were all gamblers. I mean, they gambled on anything they could gamble on. And especially they liked to play the horses. And they all had bookies, even when it was legal to bet off track in New York, when you could go just down the street to a store, they still preferred a bookie. Even my grandmother had a bookie, you know what I'm saying? He would come to her house every day so she could make little dollar bets. There was just something about that whole culture that fascinated me. I mean, my mother had grown up in an alcoholic home, and she grew up in a small town and was horribly embarrassed by the whole deal. Her mother was embarrassed by it, she was embarrassed by it, and she never drank in her life. She died a few years back, and up till then, I don't think she even had a sip ever, as far as we were told by her, and I don't think she lied about it. She was so scared and so worried about those kind of things. But as a child, I got to see in my family who was happy in our home, and it was not my mother. She was the one that took care of everybody. She was a little lady about this tall. She took care of when my dad got in trouble. She would take care of the messes. She was loving. He was fun most of the time to me as a child, and I could not understand why she gave him such a hard time about his drinking. It drove me crazy even as a young boy. I used to defend his right to drink. It bothered me so much. I would fight with my mother about her complaining about my father's drinking, you know what I'm saying? And I formed an idea, and it's usually my ideas that make life hard. And one of the original ideas was this one, that the only thing wrong with bad drinking is other people's reaction to it. If people just wouldn't complain, the rest of us could all have fun, you know what I mean? Just hang out with the right people and life would be good. What I, of course, didn't know as a kid, what it's like to really be married or be around somebody who's one of us. I had no idea what the pain was like to be around somebody you couldn't trust, who brought down all the kind of pain. He was a loving man. He loved her. And I'll get more to their story in a minute. But I watched that drinking. What I find peculiar about growing up in that kind of environment, though, is nobody in my family ever said to us, my brother and I, and then later on my sisters, don't drink. Be careful how you drink. Drinking is bad. My father made his living from alcohol. And before him, his relatives had been bootleggers. I mean, everybody had something to do with alcohol, and it was just okay. The way I see it now as an old man is looking back, they were just spending all the time trying to find some way to make it work okay. Not stop, just not to have the problems associated with it. My dad came back, got recalled into the military. And by the way, happy congratulations on Veterans Day today to anybody who served in the military. I really do appreciate your service. My dad got recalled into the Air Force. He'd been in the reserves after World War II. They brought him back in, and they had him start running the NCO clubs and the officers' clubs. And if any of you are familiar with that, that's another fun lifestyle. I mean, it was even better than the little bar he owned. We lived in nice places like Panama City Beach, Florida, for years, and he had a club right on the white sandy beach. It was just everything in it made me think, drink. Go to places where there's drinking, dancing, music. And you know what? That's actually true. It's a nice place to go. It's just some of us have a little overshoot the mark while we're there. And we moved out to California. We were going to stay a few years. He was going to retire. We were going to go back to New York, and he was going to take over the bar again that his family was running. And things happened that at the time seemed like calamities. And I'm going to talk about them a bit in my pitch, too. Because the one thing I'm never able to really know for certain is when some event has happened in my life, whether it's actually a good thing or a bad thing. I have opinions instantly, don't get me wrong. But so often, in my family at least, and in my own particular life and watching my parents, some of the catastrophes turned out to be godsends later on. And I often joke about it in AA and say things like, God, why don't you just tell me it was going to work out? Why don't you just tell me? I wouldn't have worried so long. And yet we tell each other that every meeting. You know, it's always going to work out. It just may not work out the way I thought it was going to work out. But this was way past that. So they put me into this all-boys Catholic high school. I've been to 9 different schools by the time I was in 9th grade. I'm always the new guy coming in. I've got a last name that's not that easy to say when you see it written out. I'm having to meet new people. We moved a lot. And I got to this little all-boys Catholic high school, and it was a cool place for me. And my senior year was going to be the best year I had until yesterday, I think. It was just a fun year. I was young. I was healthy. Wasn't bad looking. I wasn't in a relationship yet, so I was still happy. Life was just going along really well for me. And I wasn't a drinker, you know what I mean? I'd had sips all my life, but it just wasn't a big deal. But I went to a senior party And I just come back from spring break, and it was the perfect spring break. I mean, I had a great time. I met girls at this dance. I couldn't ask for more. I surfed in those days. I surfed better than I ever had. I had this beautiful 1940 Ford Woody station wagon. I was a happy drinker to start that first night. But I drank that night the way I was going to drink for the next 14 years. Badly. I'm the kind of drinker, if you're somewhere and I'm drinking, you never have to ask, has he been drinking? You know, there is no question that I've had something to drink. I not only slur my words, I look slurred. I have emotions that change in a heartbeat. I mean, it's exciting emotions, but I got a lot of them, and they come out. And I drank in a blackout that very first night. I had never heard the term till I came to Alcoholics Anonymous 14 years later, ever. I thought when you said you were drunk or buzzed, it was always just buzzed. Buzzed, my word for buzzed, my definition of buzzed was anything I was. You know what I mean? Slightly drinking or drunk was still buzzed. It was never drunk, unless it could be to my advantage, which I would use periodically. But I'm the kind of guy, I've never heard anybody say to me, why don't you have another one? You know what I'm saying? You know, you're really a lot of fun when you're drinking. Could you have some more? But that first week, those first days of drinking were exciting. They were fun. I had a good time. I laughed at it. Now I'm going to talk about an outside issue. Sometimes when time doesn't allow, I leave it out. But I'm going to talk about it here a little bit because it confused me by the time I got into Alcoholics Anonymous. That same summer, within a few days of my drinking escapade, I heard about what I believe to be the best value in narcotic sales in California. For the older people you might know, or even maybe some younger people. They were called Bennies. They were these white pills. You paid $1 and you got 10 of them. They were the best bargain in narcotic sales ever. And I'm going to tell you, I'm going to give you the short version of my introduction to them, because it was just a day or two after I started to drink. I heard a guy talking about them, and he called them candy. And he said, hey, this guy can get you some candy, which sounded cool. I don't know what it was, but it sounded pretty good to me. And he told me the guy's name. Now, I'm going to have to tell this story and use some kind of hip terms, because you can see I'm pretty hip. I am. And I'll emphasize those words for Sal and other people who aren't. But I called my connect. And I ordered $1 worth of Bennies. I will tell you everything tonight I tell you from the podium is the truth. I don't exaggerate it. So this guy said he can get me the Bennies. And when I went to pick up, I had become convinced that the law enforcement had found out about this big score. I don't know how I thought they knew those things. I was already paranoid. It had nothing in me. But I was driving that night a little Volkswagen that I'd painted the back side windows aquamarine blue, and I'm not real good at it, so it ran. I had no muffler, and I was drinking Coors in the bottles that week, and I'd peel the labels off and stick it on the car, so that I'm still not sure why, but I wouldn't stop by the police. If they said, how many have you had, I guess I could just go, well, I don't know, take a look. But I really thought law enforcement had found out about this big deal. And so when I'm going over there, I had to go like 2 miles. It took me over 20 minutes because I found a way to lose the tail. I thought I was being followed. I would pull into other people's driveways, turn off my car, go back home, start again, go down around the corner, come back to lose anybody behind me, right? And by the time I got over to the gas station where Bill was working, it was successful. Nobody was behind me. I pulled in and he was hiding, looking around. He thought the FBI was after him. He thought somehow they found. We were quite a pair, the two of us. And he ran over and he said, I couldn't get you the Bennies. Do you have $5? And all I had was one $5 bill, which I stupidly gave him. And he gave me this little aluminum foil packet. And he said, this is called methadrine. It'll do the same thing for you as the Bennies would have done. And then he ran off before capture. And I sped away, which is a lie. You can't speed away in a Volkswagen. But I putted out. was like the Autopia at Disneyland. I putted out of there. And again, I made all kinds of moves to lose whoever they were that was after me. And again, it worked. Nobody was behind me by the time I finally found this empty lot. And I thought I'd been cheated. It was this powder. I'd expected pills. I had no instructions. They didn't tell me anything. And it didn't look like it was worth $5 either. But I knew I had to get it in me somehow. So I put a little bit on my tongue and I waited. I think I waited about 90 seconds and nothing happened. I was convinced he scammed me somehow. So I poured it all in my mouth. I got home that night early. You know what I'm saying? I came shooting through the door. And I hadn't been talking to my parents much, but it was about to change. Honest to God, I talked till they went to bed. And I experienced a feeling I'd never had. I'm in my own home sneaking around. You know what I mean? Feeling really wicked. Like, oh my God. Looked out the window all night, chewed the inside of my mouth raw, neatened everything. Neatened things that didn't need neatening. I read a newspaper for the first time in my life. And I don't mean I glanced at it. I read the legal notices. I didn't even know there was such a thing. So when my parents got up, I resumed our talk. I had more information. You know, they never asked me another question that summer. They didn't even like look at me. I snuck around our house every night somehow by myself in the wee hours of the morning, crazed. And the reason I bring it up is this. First of all, I think it's a funny story because it was so off base. But I used speed in one form or another all the years I drank. Couldn't always get what I wanted, but I got a lot. I'll tell you this too, real quick. I was married to a lady that had gotten some diet pills. She wanted to lose some weight. They were capsules, so I would take them apart and take all the product out and fill them up with sugar, which of course made her gain weight. I'm not here to tell you I'm an addict because I don't believe I am. But here's what I'm here to tell you about why that confused me. By the time I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I didn't have any defense that I'm an alcoholic. In fact, I didn't mind. That's the worst part. I really didn't mind. If I was sitting in a bar and some pretty girl said to me, "You drink too much," I would think, "Well, thank you, so do you." I mean, I saw it as a compliment. It was like people who drank too much were the kind of people I wanted to be like. I didn't want to just be a nothing. Huh? I wanted to be out there running and chasing and doing the kind of things men like ended up doing all my life. I didn't mind being an alcoholic until I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I didn't even mind then until somebody said, "Well, if you're alcoholic, maybe you shouldn't drink." And then I wasn't sure anymore. I was like, "Well, I don't know. I drink badly, but I choose to drink badly." That there's a big difference in somebody like me and maybe you. I purposely like being drunk. I seek it out. My home group 2 weeks ago celebrated their 60th anniversary of AA. We've been going a long time. And two people were there that night, and two of them said the same thing. They were talking, and they said, "You know, it'd be kind of nice to drink like a normal drinker." And I went home and I was thinking about that. I think it'd be torture. I think it would be absolute hell to drink like a... I don't see any point drinking like a normal drinker. You know what I'm saying? If I sat down at a bar to do what I do in a bar, having a drink would be useless. To just have a little bit of a feeling and be done, what do you do then? What do you do the rest of the night? That's just not the way I drink. So when I came into AA and I was having this debate whether I was alcoholic or not, I'm sitting around thinking, well, there's a lot of evidence that I'm alcoholic. For instance, a guy in a bar gave me my first big book. Now that in and of itself, that in and of itself is a pretty good, where would you get your book, at a meeting? No, another drunk in a bar gave me a book. It didn't offend me, I didn't read it, but in fact, I talked to him yesterday, he lives in Chicago. But the point is, I'm sitting in the back and I'm and I'll get to how I got here. I'm going to do everything in reverse tonight. But I'm sitting back there, and I'm thinking, I don't know. You know, I don't know if I'm an alcoholic or not. If I hadn't been so wired all the time, I probably wouldn't have drank so much. And if I hadn't had such bad hangovers, I probably wouldn't have taken anything to help give me some energy. So maybe there's really nothing wrong with me, after all. And Clint Hodges was a famous speaker and a good speaker. He was my home group that night, the Casablanca meeting, that's my group. And he said, our first step doesn't say we're alcoholic. It says we're powerless over alcohol. Ask yourself how well you drank the times you did drink. Well, I always drank badly. But it seemed like a volitional, a purposeful thing. I wanted to be drunk. I didn't want the trouble. I just wanted the feeling and the action that came with that, my type of drinking in the places I hung out. That's all I was looking for. You know, I spent all of my life just wanting to do whatever it is I wanted to do and not have other people mad at me. Not have other people, not pay any price for my actions. Just skate by on whatever. One of the biggest delusions I suffer from even today has always been with me, and it's this. I actually think I need to figure out a formula of how to be happy. That I have to have the answer of what to do next in order to finally feel okay. I've spent too much of my life on the verge of being okay, on the verge of being happy. I just need one more thing to come into place in order to finally get, I'm almost there. Huh? I'm almost there, but I'm not. You know, I know tonight I was born disappointed. You know what I'm saying? Everything in life disappoints me. Even the things that I thought I wanted for certain. Even the things that I would have told you, once I finally get this, I can breathe again. That job, that woman, that car, get out of trouble. Whatever the it happens to be, having to always wait to feel all right is torture. But it wasn't purposeful. I never in my life have set out to hurt the people I ended up hurting. Never. That wasn't ever the point. I was just trying to get by. It's not an excuse. Because of my behavior, I knew better. But I couldn't buy into the concept that I was powerless over alcohol. Not really. Oh, I know it's a nice saying. But really, I mean, come on. So we'll get to that in a minute. So I'm 17 years old. I start drinking like that. In the big book, in the doctor's opinion, Dr. Silkworth talks about the fact that the people that came to him for help, their problems had piled up so high, he said, that they, quote, became astonishingly difficult to solve. At 17, I didn't have any problems that were astonishingly difficult to solve. I had some worries. I had some stupid things going on. But within days of my drinking, the problems started to pile up, and they piled up very, very quickly. And that's not just podium talk. I got in trouble almost instantly. The car wreck started. I met a young girl and started getting to have that whole area of my life satisfied too, which was, I'm very thankful for, quite honestly, but it caused a lot of grief. Every month we're worried about something going on there. You know, that little school I had gone to was what they called a college prep school, but nobody in my family had ever been to college. My brother was 18 months older than me. He'd started the community college in town, and we didn't really have the money to go anywhere anyway, so I signed up there. And back in my day, the Vietnam War was going on. And if you took 15 units each semester, you could delay being drafted. So the first semester, I signed up for 16 units, just out of safety. And the second semester, 15 units. So that would be 31 units by the end of the year, just in case. And by the end of that first year, I had completed 6 units. One unit was a 1-hour course, Introduction to College. I finished it. I made the whole hour. I had 2 units in handball, and I'd finished one class. And I'm 19 years old, December 26th that year, I'm sitting in boot camp thinking, How did I get here? There's always been that little hint of that pattern of why do these things keep happening to me? Now, some things are real obvious. It's because you did something stupid. But some of them weren't so obvious. I'm starting to have bad luck. I'm starting to find myself in situations I don't want to be in. And when I came back from the service, my girlfriend was pregnant. And we weren't going to get married. She was going to go away and give up our child for adoption. I was dating somebody else because I can't ever wait not to be in a relationship. In fact, I often like to have two or three. But she was getting ready to leave, and I called her one day and said, "Don't go. We'll get married." And we did. And for a little while, life settled down for me. I started working as a janitor. Went back to school, cleaned up all those F's, because I wouldn't even withdraw from school. I'd sign up and just never go back. So I had to clean all that mess up. We had another little girl a year later, so I had two children. We ended up buying a house. I got a good job. And what happened to me then has happened to me so many times, I can't tell you. Instead of being satisfied, I got that itch again. And I'm still drinking badly that whole time. I don't want to leave out alcohol. I never drank well. It wasn't like, "Oh, whoa, you did well for a while." No, I didn't. In fact, one of the conditions of our marriage was she had to guarantee me that I could go out every Friday night drinking, and she wouldn't complain, and she didn't. And while I'm on that subject, I was married two times prior to sobriety. And I used to, in my drunken crying jags some nights, tell those people, those women, you just don't love me enough. And I know now that wasn't true at all. They loved me to pieces. I just couldn't feel it enough. You can't love me enough to reassure me, because what's inside of me is too empty. What's inside of me doesn't have the ability to actually feel that kind of worth. I'm always looking outside for something. Always. I'm chasing, I'm running. It's going to be a new job. It's going to be a new relationship. It's going to be getting out of that relationship. I suffer from what I used to call as delayed clarity. Right after a major decision, I think, uh-oh. Like right after I do. You know what I'm saying? Like that evening, it's like, "Oh my God, I didn't mean that." Or right after buying a car where you got payments. I don't even like the car. I'm driving it home and I wish somebody would steal it that night. I mean, there's something in me that the thing I wanted the most as soon as I get it, it's like, "Oh my God, I got to get out of here." There's an urgency to leave. I don't leave most of the time. I just have that urgency. And then with that kind of dissatisfaction, alcohol worked wonders for me in a certain sense. Let's push aside the trouble for a minute, because that everybody knows the troubles, the arrests, the fights, the violence. I became a very violent drinker. But alcohol worked for me that last night I drank as well as it could ever work. I walked into a bar that last evening not knowing it was going to be my last evening to ever drink again, up until tonight anyway. And I had a ton of problems. My second wife and I, she was still hanging on, but I was ready for another divorce. And I was selling real estate. I was making more money than I was ever going to make the first decade sober, driving my Mercedes. Everything on the outside looked good. She looked perfect. She looked the way I needed a lady to look. She had that surfer blonde look. She's pretty. And more importantly, she had a Volkswagen van. And those are the kind of things that I like. I have certain values. And she was a nice lady. But I came in with all that kind of stuff, and none of it was fixing me at all. In fact, I was convinced that all of it was the problem, that all of it was just the wrong kind of stuff. I came in here with ideas about what I needed to do again. Some of the ladies, or some of the men too, maybe I didn't see, raised their hands tonight as Al-Anons. And let me tell you what happened to me. Late 1979, my former wife and my mother started going to Al-Anon. And the world for my family was about to change big time, huh? They learned detachment. My wife missed the with love part, but she got detachment really, really well. You know, I'm used to coming home and being yelled at, and she wasn't yelling at me anymore. I was doing every single thing I wanted. Do you have a little bit larger water? I normally prefer a 5-gallon jug if I can. Could put a spigot on it. I can. Now I'm bloated. I've lost my place. They started going to Al-Anon. And I got so uncomfortable. I'm so used to fighting. I'm so used to defending my position. And nobody's scolding me. I mean, it's a terrible feeling for someone like me. But here's my point in that I started to get to. If getting my way fixed me, I should have been fixed a long time ago. I should be fixed now. I get my way a lot. But the thing that's wrong with me, whether you want to call it alcoholism or whatever name you put to it, is nothing lasts. And that's why it's that constant treadmill of a new idea, a new place, a new family, a new town, a new something. Now, I didn't leave as much as I wanted to leave. I was always thinking of leaving, which means I'm never present, which means I'm never really okay. So that last night I walked into that bar and I got so much guilt over my wife and the first two daughters I left, my then wife and our baby that I was gonna leave, and all the shameful behavior I'd engaged in for a decade and a half. And there was a lot of trouble, a lot of hurt people. And I was terrified about the future. I'd been a good salesman, I was top salesman in this big firm, but all of a sudden I couldn't sell much anymore because I was spending all the days in the bar. I'll tell you how bad my work stuff was going. If any of you have been in real estate, you know, you go out and you take a listing. You meet people, you see their house, you write out the paperwork. Told you I drank in blackouts. I would go to your house drunk, and I would list it, and I would come back the next morning to my desk, and I would actually find all the paperwork, like Lee, so-and-so, blah, 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 blah. But I wouldn't remember being at his house. So I'd call him and say really sharp things like, "Hey, Lee, what color would you say your house is?" And I'd get responses back like, "White." I go, "Yeah, well, me too. I just wanted to make sure before I wrote it down, because I hadn't filled out the..." It never dawned on me there was anything wrong with that. I mean, I look at it now, I guess that's insanity. It's at least stupidity. I don't know where the line is in all of it. But I walked into that bar with all that pressure. I was going to be divorced soon. I was going to leave. I was going to move to Newport Beach because that would do it. Ocean air is what I need. And I sat down with my buddies, same crowd I ran with for years. And I had a beer. And as soon as I started to drink that beer, it happened. What we try to teach each other to do here happened. You know how we always say live in the moment? Try to live in the present moment. When I'm drinking, I'm in the moment. I'm there with the guys drinking. I'm not so worried about the guilt anymore. It's kind of vanished now. It's been soothed. It's quiet for a while. My mind leaves me alone for a little while. And I'm not really planning my life too much either. I might talk some big deals to people in the bar that make no sense, but I wasn't emotionally tied to them. The problem was I couldn't stay in that point. If I could have stayed in that living, and I tried. I stayed in bars hour after hour after. I gambled the same way. I played poker all night and go clean up and play again. I mean, it was just anything not to be present, anything not to feel, anything not to have to make a decision that could be wrong. You know, I know today how well I'm doing emotionally sometimes by how many Amazon packages I've gotten in the mail. You know what I'm saying? I'll just buy something. I don't know. Let me buy it. I bought a mixer one time, like a 100-pound mixer for dough. I don't mix any dough. I never made anything with it. It was a thought. I acted on it. But that last night I'm in there drinking and I'm carrying on. I don't have any idea it's going to be my last night. I went into a blackout. I remember coming to on a curb, and there's always a pretty young lady somewhere in the story. I'll just leave them out tonight. But there's this girl standing there, and she's looking at me and asking me a question I had been asked since I was 17. What's the matter with you? I mean, I have a lot of answers for it. None of them are correct, right? But I'll give them an answer. I remember one time being at spring break, the second spring break, right after I started drinking. And I came out of a blackout and I heard a lady's voice say to me, "Are those your trunks at the bottom of the pool?" And they were. I got evicted the first day of spring break. I mean, I always come out of blackouts to questions that are hard to answer or explain to somebody. But I slipped back into a blackout, and the next morning, May the 30th, 1980, I woke up and I was at my friend Frank's house. I'd slept on his couch again. I'd spent a lot of nights over at Frank's. And I'm allergic to cats. Yeah, he had a white cat. It slept on my head, or right near my head. I always had bad hangovers, so I was extra sick that day. My eyes were swollen, nearly shut. You know, I couldn't breathe. I was nauseous. It was 6 in the morning. I was quite a stud. And I drove down to the Del Taco and got a chocolate milkshake because I believe in nutrition. And I took a Black Beauty. If any of you know what those are, they're peppy. And I'm driving along, and a feeling came over me that I must have had before, but that morning I remembered it clearly. I don't know where to go. I see the world. I still had a job and I still had a family, but I didn't know where to go. I mean, it was like the world had a big, thick pane of glass between me and everybody. And I think it was sadness, but at least it was lonesomeness. And I'm driving along, and I was just so upset. Now, what I didn't tell you was about 3 weeks before that, I'd gone up to Las Vegas and gotten in some trouble, pretty good trouble. It was such good trouble, I still think about it with enjoyment. That's the kind of trouble it was. But I knew I was in trouble, and my wife, I told you, was going to Al-Anon, and I knew I should do something. So to get the heat off, I went to my first AA meeting, and I walked in there, and I felt as out of place there as I do everywhere. I didn't know anything about AA, nothing. I mean, I didn't feel welcome. In fact, if people talked to me, it made me miserable. And I sat down near the front where the leader was, and he had a gavel. And it was a participation meeting. And I'm too cool to talk. By that point in my life, I won't even yell out bingo at a bingo game. You know what I mean? Even if I got it out of fear, maybe there's no 067 or something. I can't look bad. But I accidentally sat in front of him, and I didn't know it. And he hit the table, and he would call on people. And I was sick to my stomach that he was going to ask me to say something. So I pretended to be asleep so he wouldn't call me. We're right like this far apart. But I often suffer from simultaneous but conflicting emotions. And as soon as he didn't call me, my feelings were hurt. You know, something like that. And by the end of the... I wouldn't have spoken, don't get me wrong. I'm too cool to talk, but... He should have at least asked. You know. But then they held hands and said the Lord's Prayer, and I thought, oh my God, this is so sad. Look at them. Look at these people. What if somebody from the bar drives by and sees this? I'll be humiliated. I went home, my wife asked me, she said, "What do you think?" I said, "It's terrible. I laid it on thick, how bad AA was. I'm never going back." And she was smart enough, her Al-Anon was good enough. She said, "Okay. What are you going to do?" I said, "Well, I'm not going to drink for 30 days. But don't ever mention AA to me again." And she said, "All right." I made it 10 days. And I started thinking. Thought, why'd you say 30 days? Why didn't you say 10 days? Or better yet, one day. You're a man, for God's sakes. Who can tell you not to drink? And I went back on my run. You know, about a year and a half later, I was at a meeting. And a man started coming around to our groups. He took his first year cake. I knew his face, didn't know him well. He got up and he gave a little talk, and he said he went to that first meeting and he felt the same way. I thought it was so unique. I thought everybody else came in here and wanted to be here. Oh God, let's hug again before we leave. He said he felt just as awkward. He thought it was silly. You know, the same kind of feelings. But he was an AA genius. He went home, and when his wife asked him what he thought, he said he thought it would help. He said it would help him, her, the kids. It just didn't stop. He said there was only one problem with it. He said that Alcoholics Anonymous was such a popular organization in Riverside, it was full. There was no more room. And he said he was on a waiting list. I swear. He said they were going to call when there was an opening. But in the meantime, it was okay to drink. And I looked at him, I thought, he's a genius. Why didn't somebody tell me that? By then I had a year and a half invested. I come up all the way here to tell you that, whoever needs it to take home. Because here's what I believe to be the truth, for me and for the people I've known in AA. When it was my time to get sober, it was my time to get sober. Whether I knew it or not, whether I saw any value in it, whether I was comfortable around people, didn't make any difference, I know, with hindsight. It was terrifying to me. It was sickening to me. I didn't want to give up hanging out with the guys. I didn't want to let go of chasing and running and gambling and doing the stuff I was doing. I wasn't looking for any of that. I wasn't looking for anything except for a way to live where you'd leave me alone. Just leave me alone. I'll pay any price I have to, but do not make me stop doing the only things that finally make me comfortable. May the 30th morning, I ended up going back to where that meeting was. They had a little 3-week, 21-day program. I checked myself in with no intention of getting sober, but so I could get my life together to move to Newport, to get a divorce and get out of real estate. On my 19th day there, 2 days to go, I've almost made it. Sunday night, the H&I panel comes in, and I know some of you do a lot of H&I work. And I'm forever grateful to that little old white-haired man who came in that night. He looked like me, very nondescript. It's a shame that you turn into that at 43 years, but it happens. And I'm watching TV and they came in and said, the panel's here. And I'm thinking, I'm watching a movie. And the lady goes, turn it off. I waddled in with the other guys and we're sitting there. And the panel's sitting at this table and there's like three chairs and he's by himself. And they said, this is the hospital institution's panel. And I'm thinking, that's not a panel. You have to have two or more people to have a panel. I'm in a debate by myself. And she leaves, and the panel's blabbing like I'm doing. And I'm mumbling to other people, that's not a panel. You know, that's not really a panel. You have to have two. And the other guys are saying to me, can you shut up? I couldn't. I would like to have shut up, but I couldn't shut up. It bothered me so much. Panel's blabbing. I'm daydreaming like a lot of you are doing. And then he said something that brought me out of my own thoughts for a minute. Because I can't stop my thinking once it's on a run. Do you know what I'm saying? It just runs. It's like, okay, go. And he said, you want to know what I found here in Alcoholics Anonymous? And I thought, no, I do not. I don't care at all what you found, in fact. And then he said it a second time. Anger can get me focused. He goes, do you want to know what I found here in Alcoholics Anonymous? And I'm thinking, no, I don't want to know. Nobody in the room wants to know. Nobody cares. For God's sakes, let us go back to TV. And he said, I'm going to tell you. Now I'm so mad, I'm staring at him so he knows that I'm mad. It doesn't do any good to be mad if no one knows you're mad. So I'm glaring at him from the back. And he goes, I'm going to tell you what I found. And I'm thinking, what? You made friends? Oh, yippee. I got friends. I found God. I'm not looking. I'm staying away. Found an AA potluck. Yay, great. I'll bring the chips. He said, here's what I found. I have a higher degree of mental comfortableness. I have peace of mind. And for a moment, my mind left me alone because I didn't have peace of mind. He said, I'm going to go home to a wife I love. I'm going to sleep on clean sheets. I'm going to get up in the morning. I'm going to fix my lunch in my lunch pail. I'm going to have breakfast with my kids. I'm going to go to work and give them 8 hours of work for 8 hours of pay and come home and be with my family. You know, I missed my family those nights drinking. I just couldn't go home. I might miss out on something in the bar. I might miss out on some action. I would just miss him and tell you how much I missed him, but not go home. And then he said, after dinner, I'll go to a meeting and smoke cigarettes and drink coffee. I've never had it so good. Those of you who've been in AA for any length of time know what he was talking about, huh? Serenity. the direct result of working the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous and surrender. The ability or the attempted ability to quit trying to run his own life. He stunned me so much that I went to my room and I started to read the big book. I'd never read it by myself. I read it in groups, but never by myself. Bill Wilson's writings have a way to soothe my emotions even on bad days. They don't fix them all the time, but they bring them down to a more manageable level. I started listening to people in meetings, and I listened to them say things like, whatever they did and the kind of stuff that they were talking about, but I was listening more for their feelings. I heard him talking about a speaker from Los Angeles who'd spoken somewhere that week. And I always had trouble with decisions. I know why now. I'm always afraid I'm going to cheat myself somehow. But they said this lady had spoken at their group, and she said that she had some trouble making decisions, that when she was in the supermarket in the meat department, she wished there was just one more kind of animal. I thought, I understand that. I mean, that's the kind of stuff I suffer from. Petty, stupid things like that, frozen. They were talking a lot about we're supposed to be happy, joyous, and free. The book talks about it. We insist on it. I want to be happy, joyous, and free. My natural state is not happy, joyous, and free. It's the opposite. It's worried. It's angry. It's tense. It's tied down to thoughts that have plagued me for years that recur. I've changed it for me a little bit. I still want to be happy, joyous, and free. But I'll tell you what I've substituted for it. I want to be content. I want to be okay with where I am in the world, whether you tell me I'm okay or not, whether I get special recognition or not, whether everything I wanted works out or not. I just want to not always be figuring out an answer. The great delusion for me, the mistaken belief for me is that I can figure out a way to finally put it all together and be okay, because I can't. And by the way, when I was in that little hospital place, that 21-day place, it was in a hospital. My father, who was still drinking even worse than he had been when I lived at home, my mother told him one night, they want you to go to the family group. Now, it was only a mile from that facility, but she wouldn't let him ride with her, right? That's how well they were doing. So he drove over there and he went, and he got to the Al-Anon room, and there was a greeter at the door, and she welcomed him, and then she smelled the alcohol on him. And she said, sir, you want the meeting up the hall? And he goes, he didn't know. I go, okay. So he wandered up the hall. He got sober that week, and he stayed sober until he died. He loved Alcoholics Anonymous. He was a quiet man in AA, but he went to every meeting, even when he had cancer at the end. He would pick up the chairs, do his little jobs, and do all this stuff. I mean, he'd done a lot of damage to himself. He hurt my mom a lot, but they stayed together. They never did divorce, and they finally had a life with all the pain and the stuff. Their love was a really strong love. You know, I can't say enough for Alcoholics Anonymous. My brother got sober a year later and still hadn't had a drink either. So next time, help me hold this bottle up for me. It's a little heavy. Anyway, that started all that. I asked a man to sponsor me that week. I know Lee knows, and some of you may know, there's a group in Los Angeles called the Pacific Group. Don had moved to my hometown from the Pacific Group. Clancy was his sponsor. I knew nothing about that group, those kind of people, nothing. I knew nothing about AA. But he looked rich, and I asked him to sponsor me. It turned out he had declared bankruptcy that first year. That's how good a pick I am on people. But he was a perfect sponsor for me. And he told me this. He said, you know what? He told me a lot of things, but one of the big ones was this. He said, you're not going to make any major changes your first year sober. You're not quitting your job. You're not moving to Newport. You're not getting a divorce for sure. And to this night, I don't know why I listened to him, but I am really grateful for strong sponsorship and the variety that made me take actions, not just understanding things. We didn't sit down and discuss it first. There was never a discussion. I was just told, do this. Show up at the meeting early. Go meet five people you don't know. Those kind of things were hard. I have a pretty good sized meeting. There's still 200 people at the Casablanca meeting. He started out one night because I was complaining about people, which I like to do. And he said, I want you to go meet five people you don't know. I was sick to my stomach. I'd go over to five of you at once and do it real quick and then run back to my seat and think, oh God, how'd I do? Shit, I missed the rest of the meeting thinking about how I looked. And then I would tattle on him about something else. Somebody hurt my feelings. He'd say, I want you to go meet 10 people. Introduce yourself. I didn't catch on. I was damaged. One night, somebody had said something to hurt my feelings, so I went up to tattle. And Don was big and loud, too, and you could never keep it quiet. Could I tell you something? No, what? And I went, he goes, you know what? You're so sick. Come here. And he took me to the front door. We didn't have greeters. He said, you're going to meet everybody who comes in. Everybody. I'm standing there alone like a puppet. Hello. You know, most people are nice, but there was one guy named Bob. I go, hi. He made me do it every week, too, not just that week. Bob would come in. I go, hi, Mike. He'd go, who cares? But, and I'm sensitive. I'm angry and sensitive, new. But I was mopping the floors in those days. And Bob never put away his chair and did stuff, I noticed. I would always manage to mop Bob's shoes with a dirty mop while he was talking to his AA friends. I'm a very petty man. And and then one day, Don brought another guy over and he goes, stand here next to him. You're so sick. I looked at the guy and go, you are. You're very sick. And I explained to him the benefits of shaking hands, somehow like I thought of it. That first year didn't come like I wanted to. I owed the IRS money. The Mercedes was gone. Paying back things. I can't sell like I could when I was drinking. I'm watching other people. They seem to be going up on the economic scale. I'm going down. I'm thinking, where's this God? But one of the people that Don took me to hear speak frequently was a man named Chuck Chamberlain, Chuck C. Tremendous AA speaker of a different variety than the just entertainment variety, although he was entertaining. Because he talked about his belief in a higher power. He got right to it. He talked about an opinion he had that there really was a higher power that actually took care of us, that actually took care of the details of our lives. He used to say this, I'm either going to run my life and take the consequences thereof, or I'm not going to run it and take the consequences thereof. Which is it going to be? And you know, I've tried to incorporate into my world a lot, especially the longer I've been around. I ask myself several times a day, am I going to run my life today, or am I going to try to ask a higher power to run it? And I'll get into my beliefs about that in a minute. But I started listening to people like him talk about that when they surrendered, when they quit trying to push to have their own way, how life got better. That was more important to me than how do you not drink. I was 90 days sober and the urge to drink hit me. I was down in Oceanside where Lee and I had a sponsor named Cliff. And I was out in the water in the surf, and the urge to drink had hit me that morning, and I couldn't get it out of my mind. And my family didn't know enough about AA yet. I could have told them we drank every 90 days, huh? And they would have been very happy. And I came in, and I got my street clothes on, and I was going to go buy a six-pack. I was just so angry. I don't remember what I was there angry about that day, but I was angry. I think because I couldn't have fun. I'm not sure what it was. And instead of actually going to the liquor store, I got on my knees and I said a prayer to anything. I'm so pissed. I'm so frustrated. If you really exist, I'm going to drink today. And when I got up off my knees, the urge to drink had vanished, and I've never had it come back, ever. I told you all the pills and the lines and the speed I took. The difference for me between drinking and using, both in large quantities, was I never have ever wanted to be wired again since I quit being wired, huh? I've never had that craving, I've never had that, any of that. The lifestyle stuff sometimes comes and goes for any of my bad behavior, don't get me wrong, but it had nothing. I know I'm not an addict, I just used a lot of enhancements to keep going while I was drinking, you know what I'm saying? Anyway, I start following his direction. At the end of the first year, I'm applying for work, trying to get all kinds of jobs, and I'm not getting anything. that I thought. And I'm going, where's that higher power? Everybody talks about this loving higher power. How come I'm not getting it? I almost got one job. It was perfect. Perfect. I've been through 3 interviews. And I drove up to sign the papers on Monday, and they said, we've been trying to reach you all weekend. And I was out camping. We've got a hiring freeze. I'm sorry. And I'm thinking, where's this God, for goodness sakes? There's no God. Not that it actually gets involved, at least. A little while later, I got a job offer from Orange County, California, as a probation officer. And I told them the truth. They knew about my alcoholism, my drug use, my little arrest, all this stuff, because you told me to tell the truth. And you know, I was grateful to get that offer until my first day of work. And then as soon as I got there, I realized it was a mistake. And I called my sponsor. I said, I'm not staying here. That's a stupid job. And my sponsor said, you know what? They don't care what you think. You're going to stay there 1 year, and we'll talk about it at the end of the year. He got caught on the 1 year thing for 8 years straight, and I never caught on. That's how sad I am. As a result of working there, these little kids I'm supposed to be supervising never went to school. But I'd go by their little continuation school, and 3 or 4 blocks down the street is a law school. And I thought, well, I'll go to school. So I called Don, and I signed up for one class. And the very first night, I realized that was a mistake. So I called and I said, I'm not going to do this. And he goes, yeah, you are. People like you are quitters. Yes, I know. And he said, nobody cares if you become a lawyer, but you're going to finish the one class. And we did that every semester for the next 3.5 years. I became a lawyer. I was going to be a real estate lawyer. I had it all planned out. They've always got the plan. And through a series of things that I don't think I could have made happen had I desired them, I had a man ask me, will you come to work in the district attorney's office? And I said, I don't think you want people like me there. And they do a background investigation, and they had the investigator call me, and he said, I need to see you. I thought, I bet you do. And and he interviewed me in a old jail cell. You know that sound. Close that door. And he goes, we've been looking at your background. He asked me the same questions they asked me in Orange County, though. What are you doing about it? And I said, I'm in AA. He goes, really? You have a sponsor? I go, yes. And he said, you know, my dad's in AA. He's got like 25 years. I'm going to sign you off. Now, I went in there, and I didn't fit with those people. They weren't, well, I didn't think I did. It turned out I did. I told you how scared I was of speaking. They do trials in the DA's office. They put me into my first trial. My third day there, I didn't even know how to do a trial. I never had taken a trial class because I wasn't going to do any. And my boss said, I want you to go over there and start. The public defender's going to go first. They were talking about some kind of motions or something. And I said, I don't know what to do. And he said, well, you just do whatever he does, but say the opposite, and I'll be over later. It was a little nickel and dime cheesy case. DUI, I think it was. I won the case, because it wasn't that hard. Turned out I had a talent. I became chief of homicide. And I spent my whole career as the head of the homicide unit. Well, it was not just homicide. It was gangs, homicides, and sex crimes. I was immersed in violence. In my county, we went out to death scenes. So I have been out to lots of violent settings. And I've spent decades dealing with that kind of aftermath. And here's how it helped me as far as AA goes. It helped me to quit blaming God. You know, in the big book, on one of the pages that I happen to know, on page 134, it says in there, we created our own misery. God didn't do it. It is so easy to put the blame on God, especially in violent situations and in hard things in the world. I remember at a baby death one time, people trying to console each other were going, you know, we don't know God must have needed another little angel. And I'm not here to say, I'm not going to comment on that, but here's my take on it. God does not do bad things to us. Not to teach us a lesson, not to get even, not for punishment, nothing. Because if that were true, I tell you, I wouldn't be standing here tonight with the life I've got. My bad actions bring their own consequence. It isn't God that did it. If I'm angry enough to kill you, I can kill you. If I'm angry enough to steal from you or harm you in any other way, I can do it. It isn't a result of the higher power trying to teach a lesson, in my humble opinion. And so watching all that firsthand, I may have come to it anyway, but that brought it in faster to my mind, to quit blaming God. Last December, my middle daughter, who lives up in Oregon, called me. She's a school teacher, a happily married school teacher. And she went to the dentist because she'd been having some pain, but she didn't want to miss class. She was diagnosed with stage 4 cancer 2 weeks later, a really nasty cancer. When I got off the phone, the first thing I tried to do was to say a prayer. Not to cure her, although I would love that. But I asked God to help me not be mad at him if she doesn't live. And not to blame any higher power for her sickness. It's just sickness. I don't like it. And she's really sick. She's still alive, though. She's lived longer than they thought she'd live. But here's my point about it. It wasn't to tell you a sad story. It's to tell you this. If I start assigning everything that happens to whether God did it or not, I'm in a lot of trouble. Because I don't know what God does. And I won't know until I die unless God happens to tell us. I don't know, even if he does that. But I got some stories I'll tell you real quick. I sponsor a guy named Mark. Everybody has their own opinion what God does. One night I met him at my little Monday night participation meeting, and Mark raised his hand and he said, "Hey, I got an eviction notice today." Now, he failed to tell me that. I'm his sponsor, but he happened to just leave that out. And he said, "Yeah, I got an eviction notice. I guess God's trying to teach me a lesson." So after the meeting, I called him aside and I said, "Mark, that wasn't God, that was your landlord who was trying to teach you that lesson." I need that kind of clarity brought home to me sometimes when I'm lost in my own thoughts. I sponsored a guy named Chris. He had no money. He was living in a group home somewhere. He called me. He goes, "I bought a car today." "Where'd you get a car?" He goes, "At a junkyard." I go, "Does it run?" And he said, "You know what we do here in AA?" He had like 2 months. He was explaining to me. And he goes, "We just do the footwork. It's up to God." Well, I'm here to report God didn't want that car to run. So we went back and got his $200 back. I mean, I laugh about it, but I slip into that kind of thinking. When I'm sitting alone, my mind attacks me. It's the tortures of my mind that make life hard. It isn't most reality. Sad things happen. Hard things happen. I can get through them because I've watched you get through them. I've watched friends lose their children in AA. I've watched how painful it is. I went through a divorce when I was 15 years sober, brought about by my own actions, basically. I wanted the divorce. I watched what it was like to disrupt a family when you've been active in AA and fairly public. And the only lesson I can come up with isn't about behavior. I could talk to you about that if we ever needed to. It's for some reason my higher power still loves me enough to make my life okay. It does not mean I don't pick up the consequences for my actions, because I do. But what it does mean is I don't have to drink and use no matter what I have done or not done. And I also don't have to always put the blame on somebody else. I think God does want us to be happy, joyous, and free. But I don't think he makes a person with my emotions and mental disabilities free from mental torture. The only time that works for me is when I'm living in the now. When I come back to today and try to trust. There was an old speaker named Father Martin. Some of you may have heard of him. And he used to tell that great story about the man walking along at dark and falls off the side of a cliff. And he's terrified, and as he's falling and falling, he reaches out and he finally grabs hold of a branch. And as he's hanging there, when he can talk, he finally yells out, "God, if you're up there, help me." And God yells back, I'm up here. Let go of the branch. And the man yells back up, anybody else up there? And the story ends where the daylight comes and he's only hanging a foot off the ground. He could have let go at any time. I was on homicide call one night, on call out before cell phones. And I left my number at the house. Anyway, I'm at this point, my pitch, getting ready to finish. Phone rings in the back, secretary gets up, runs back, comes back with a piece of paper. And it says Sergeant so-and-so from the sheriff's department's on the phone, so I knew what the call was about. And on the way back, I'm thinking, oh my God, he knows I'm here. Oh God, he knows I'm here. So I get there and I pick up the phone, his name was Skip. And I said, and he starts talking. I said, wait a minute. I'm at an AA meeting. I just wanted you to know that's why I'm over here. And he goes, yeah, I know. Okay, so what? And the reason I told him that was I was afraid he thought I attended the Church of the Nazarene. Not that there's anything wrong with that, but I realized my membership in AA has never hurt me, not my career, not anything. It's only maybe made me useful, for as useful as I can be when I'm not wrapped up in self. I have a sponsor today that Lee and I share, and I tell him the truth. And the other thing that I think I owe, I know this is long, but I need to say this because I sometimes forget it. It is pointless for me to lie to you and pretend I'm happy, joyous, and free when I'm not. If I can't share to you that sometimes in sobriety I don't even want to be here, that sometimes I don't like being at meetings, that people annoy me, that I don't even, I can't make any kind of contact. Chuck C., the most spiritual human I've ever known, said he had a whole year that when praying was like blowing smoke up a chimney. It had no effect. He couldn't make a contact. If that can happen to people that believe that strongly, it can happen to me. It comes back. I have to ride through my emotions, and that's why taking the actions of sobriety are more important for me than understanding it all. Thanks for letting me share. Amen.